You're listening to a Bellingcat Discord server stage talk titled Politics in the Age of Disinformation. Author and political writer Sasha Eisenberg joined us on stage, unpacking his latest book, The Lie Detectives, which looks at the response to the fake news movement in the Trump era. You can find links to all of Sasha's books in the description of this podcast. In this popular talk, Sasha answered audience questions on predictions for the upcoming elections and how parties are preparing to tackle disinformation and misinformation online. Talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Mott, on Thursday the 28th of March in the Bellingcat Discord server. To this week's Bellingcat Stage Talk. We're lucky to be joined by Sasha Eisenberg today. Sasha is an author of 5 books. You may have read his 2012 book, The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, which Politico called Moneyball for Politics. Now he's promoting his new book, The Lie Detectives, which unpacks the movements of the Democratic Party during Trump's presidential era and markets itself as a playbook for winning elections in the disinformation age. Today, we'll be discussing the upcoming US elections. Yes, 2024 is that year of elections, and what impact disinformation and fake news is likely to have, including how us as researchers may be able to spot the signs of a disinformation campaign starting to take hold. But first, Sasha is going to give us a short overview of the main themes of his most recent book and the lessons that might be taken from it. As he talks, please put all of your questions in the chat. As we go along, I will ask them as we move into the Q&A section. Please note that nobody else will be on the stage apart from myself, Sasha, and perhaps another Bellingcat staff member. If you do want to ask a question, please do write it in the chat and I will answer it as we go along. Okay, I'm going to turn off my mic now. Sasha, please take the stage.
Thank you, Charlie. Thanks for having me. I've been a longtime reader and fan and student of Bellingcat. Real admirer of what you guys do. So it is both exciting and a little intimidating to be here talking to you. So let me tell you a little bit first about who I am and how I came to this topic. I, as Charlie mentioned, I wrote a book called The Victory Lab. It came out in 2012, shortly before Barack Obama's reelection. And it was basically a chronicle of a scientific revolution that had taken place within American political campaigns over the previous decade. And I was basically chronicling two major strands of innovation. One, which had been informed by the social sciences, was the use of these randomized control trials to finally test what was effective in campaign contact. And the other, informed by consumer marketing and new statistical tools, was the introduction of all sorts of data that became available to political campaigners that allowed them to better profile individual voters and sort of target their communications. And it was a largely optimistic, cheery book about how technological innovation was shaping politics. You know, what had happened in the United States was that these tools were by and large used for campaigns to become more effective at registering and mobilizing voters. I think it's one reason we've seen an uptick in voter turnout in the last generation in the United States. And also for campaigns to become better at delivering information or arguments that they thought were well tailored to the interests and curiosities of the voters who received them. It was a story about technology making campaigns better at connecting with people. And I wrote very little about the internet in that book for a bunch of reasons that are probably too arcane to get into here. But a lot of these innovations were about how to get better at knocking on doors and sending direct mail to people's post boxes and such. And so the internet was only really at the margins of my story. But the way broadly, I think the story I told about this sort of pre-digital innovation was of a piece with the way that we talked about the way that online campaigning was changing. I think I sent the manuscript of my book to the publisher this was happening as the Arab Spring was beginning, and the sort of mythology that we the standard mythology we tell there about, you know, is the one guy in Cairo who didn't have access to a newspaper or a state media outlet, but had a Twitter account, could send a message that said, you know, come down to Tahrir Square. And he was able to start a mass movement without any of the traditional media infrastructure or sort of political, you know, long-term political organization that would have been necessary to do that in a pre-internet era. And what with time, I sort of had to confront the ways in which that take broadly and my what I wrote in that book was naive. And I the moment that crystallized this for me was I was writing for Bloomberg in 2016, and with a colleague of mine at Businessweek, Josh Green, spent some part of a week in San Antonio, Texas, where Donald Trump had located his digital operation. And we ended up writing two stories for Businessweek about this. And one of them, we quoted a senior Trump campaign official who described, and I believe this is a direct quote, three major voter suppression efforts that they had underway. And then this person went on to explain to us how they were using Facebook dark posts to target particular geographic zones or sort of demographic subgroups with messages or content that were designed to turn them away from the process. Basically, you know, take people who might be Hillary Clinton supporters and discourage them from voting. And it was the first time that I, in having reported on this sort of general world of cutting edge politics, had encountered somebody who was sort of speaking the language of modern high tech campaigning to describe something that we could consider an anti-democratic practice. And obviously, in the years since, we've seen all sorts of efforts to use, particularly social media, but the tools of the internet to not just drive voters or citizens away from political participation, but to mislead, confuse them. And it has become, you know, I think one of the major challenges for people in every space, you know, as you all are well aware. But I wanted to focus in this book, and the reason I sort of returned to this area of political innovation was it seemed to present a very specific challenge to campaigners. And I focus, I write mostly about the US, but also about Brazil at some length and spend some time reporting there. But I think this is a universal challenge, you know, and the thing that's most interesting to me conceptually about this is the sort of asymmetry that is created campaigning in this era. And, you know, all the sort of strategies and tactics that the traditional political campaign developed were predicated on an idea that your opposition was largely operating under the same constraints you were, constraints of law, constraints of various forms of certainly in the US, of transparency. Start my narrative in 2016, in the aftermath of Trump's victory. You know, just about everybody in around the world is shocked in some form or another by the outcome. And among people in the sort of within the Democratic Party, political professionals, inquiry, you know, is aimed in a lot of different things, right? You know, failures of Hillary Clinton's campaign, her weaknesses as a candidate, geographic areas where she underperformed, whatever. But one line of inquiry is about all the things that had sort of happened on the internet over the course of 2016 that had not been fully understood or contextualized at the time. And so you have this moment in late 2016, early 2017, where senior people at the Democratic National Committee, the major labor unions, big donors, people who are making decisions about the priorities of the American left are start asking a bunch of questions. These are people who've been around political campaigns in the US sometimes for decades, and they're asking questions because there's a whole new vocabulary that they've never been exposed to in the context of a political campaign. You know, what's a bot farm? What's a troll? What is, you know, what is a hack and dump operation? And they have to first become familiar with this language, but more importantly, think about how you integrate your thinking about these new challenges into all the other strategic and tactical objectives that one has as a campaign. And so the sort of main character of my story is this woman named Jory Craig, who she's a 25-year-old from Illinois. She participated in Model United Nations in high school, was interested in foreign affairs, had never been involved in American politics, ends up working after graduating from university for a consulting firm in Washington, a Democratic consulting firm that almost through an accident of history developed the largest international consulting practice of any firm in Washington. So it's a firm called Greenberg Quinlan Rosner. Stan Greenberg, one of the founders of the firm, was Bill Clinton's pollster, but he also happened to be Nelson Mandela and Ehud Barak and Tony Blair's pollster. And so starting in the 90s, the firm just started getting business overseas. And so Jory Craig is this 22-year-old American who's working as a junior digital staffer. And her first assignment is she gets sent to Moldova to advise a parliamentary leader how to get on Facebook. And then she gets sent to Gabon and the Philippines and Panama and the Bahamas. And by the time 2016 rolls around, she's watching the Clinton-Trump race from abroad. But after the election, all of these people in the sort of senior ranks of the American left, their questions start leading them back to Jory Craig, because she's never worked on a campaign in the United States, but she, to some extent, has the most valuable, relevant experience to the questions they're asking, because a lot of the things that were novel in 2016 in the US are not novel in electoral politics, right? So foreign interference, a major shock for many Americans to you know, especially as outlined in the Mueller report, to see the role that a foreign intelligence service played. Obviously, you know, across the world, it is in no way unusual to have a foreign government or foreign business interest, sometimes quite overtly getting involved in trying to shape another country's electoral politics. You know, the rise of partisan and ideologically motivated media, which in the United States, you know, was prevalent in the 19th century, largely disappeared in the 20th century as our media institutions aspired to some form of nonpartisan neutrality and sort of marginalized those that were seen to have a partisan or ideological agenda. Obviously, in almost every one of our peer countries, that is the sort of norm for major media organizations. The persistence of rumor and conspiracy theory, which I think has shaped domestic American politics in some pretty monumental ways in the last 7 or 8 years. Obviously, there are parts that you go to the Middle East and people just assume that rumor is one of the vectors by which information and argument travel through the citizenry. But I think for Americans, this has been a sort of radical discovery. And so because Jory Craig had worked in these sort of foreign environments, if you take away some of the novelty of sort of digital disinformation, many of these dynamics were things that she had helped candidates' parties navigate. And she sort of becomes the main character of my story, and moves through other institutions on the left. But this is, you know, largely the story of her trying to explain to American political campaigners, one, how to identify what disinformation or misinformation online is actually an electoral problem for them. I mean, I think one of the ways, and we get into this in the conversation, that, you know, political campaigns have a very different goal than media organizations do, than academics who study disinformation, which is they're fundamentally concerned on what will affect their votes. So one is guiding them to be able to make smart and proportionate decisions about disinformation online, and for often not to panic, which has been the sort of key problem, I think, for political actors, and I think also for media organizations and others. And then how to, because there are all these perils, which you all are probably very well aware of, right? That you draw attention to something that's not getting attention. There's all this cognitive science about if you rebut a lie the wrong way, you can end up sort of reinforcing it in the minds of people who hear it. Obviously, the algorithms of social media in particular are designed to reward engagement. And so, you know, you try to fact check something or dunk on it because it's wrong, you can end up actually driving people to it. And then the bigger pitfall, I think, is, you know, for campaigners, but this is true for you know, institutions, marketers, is the idea that, you know, a campaign has a whole bunch of things it needs to get done every day. It wants to communicate to persuadable voters. It wants to communicate to its own supporters. It wants to communicate to you know, interest groups that might endorse it. And if you spend all day responding to whatever is sort of popping up online, you are probably not sort of following those objectives and are going to spend time talking about things that you don't want to be talking about. And so I will open up to questions on that note.
Thank you so much, Sasha, for breaking down the themes of your book and for giving us a little background to the central character as well. Really useful. Just a reminder to anyone in the audience, make sure that you're asking the questions in the chat because I'll be reading them out from there. And we've already had a few come through, which is great. I wanted to quickly ask before we go to audience questions, for anybody who might be listening, and I think in this audience generally, we probably have quite a deep understanding of this, but in case somebody's listening, particularly on the podcast recording, what does election disinformation campaigns look like? And could you give an example of one that has struck you as being particularly powerful through your research?
Yeah, I think the ones that, you know, this can be everything from one individual mistruth in a post, right? Or, and I should say, like, from the, you know, there's obviously a vocabulary that academic researchers, I think, care deeply about, and the platforms to some degree about the difference between disinformation, misinformation, malinformation. Frankly, from the perspective of campaigns, it is the actual, one of the things that really became clear in my time reporting on this is that those are meaningless distinctions from a campaign. And ultimately, I think that the sort of important divide is between not truth and falsity in this area, but between sort of centralized, traditional centralized media and decentralized media. The idea of having to engage with communicators who are not sort of constrained by or accountable to the same things you are. So we there are discrete falsehoods that move online, right? Obviously, there's increased interest now in deep fakes, given AI capabilities, right? In the last few months in the US, there was an instance in New Hampshire before the primary that has been under investigation by the Attorney General there, where a Democratic voters received a robocall, an automated recorded phone call that had a plausible version of Joe Biden telling them not to vote in the Democratic primary because it would be waste of their vote or something. There was so anyway, that's an example of a audio deepfake that moved offline, frankly. So obviously created with online tools, presumably, but not was delivered by phone. And then I think the things that have been most effective have had the greatest impact on American politics are things that are, I think, beyond individual bits of disinformation, but things that grow into totalizing conspiracy theories. And you know, I'll name three that are obviously pretty familiar to everybody. QAnon, the post-2020 election, there was, you know, denial of the election results and all the attendant conspiracies about that, and disinformation, misinformation related to the coronavirus and especially vaccine effectiveness, you know, have all had a very significant effect on our politics in a ongoing way.
You mentioned the Joe Biden AI audio issue. I just put in the chat that it's not just the US elections that have been impacted by deepfake audio already. The Slovakian elections last year also had an instance where a leading political figure and a journalist, they kind of copied their voices and created a fake audio that made it sound like they were trying to sabotage the election.
And I should say to that point, Charlie, that this is one of the
areas where I think the practice of politics is converging in a cross-border way. I think if you go back in 20 years, the ways in which you run for office in Slovakia versus Brazil versus Indonesia versus, you know, Idaho were radically different, right? There were local laws, campaign finance laws, tax laws, the communications infrastructure of countries was very different. The political culture of, you know, do you talk to strangers about politics? Do you promote your candidate? Like, you know, things were so, I recall, you know, just in 2012, going to France before the presidential election to report on some of the mechanics of campaigns and some people who were trying to apply some of the lessons I'd written on the Victory Lab about door knocking to François Hollande's campaign for president. And so much of it was the difficulty. Data was organized differently on voters, what you could or could not sort of say in culturally acceptable ways at the door about politics was different. And a decade later, I'm in Brazil, and the conversation that I'm having in 2012, the conversations I had with French political operatives about their jobs and American political operatives about their jobs were radically different because of local factors. 10 years later, I'm in Brazil, and the conversations I'm having with political operatives in Brazil and the conversations I'm having with political operatives in the United States are close to identical because they are communicating with the same tools on the same platforms, navigating the same sort of information environment. And so, you know, my book focuses mostly on the U.S. and Brazil, but I'm glad you brought up Slovakia. And my guess is that it's hard to find a country that has not been shaped, you know, that has democratic elections that over the last decade have not been in some way shaped by some version of this threat.
Yeah, it's definitely a global threat, and it needs global solutions. Something that I was going to mention with the Slovakia elections is that what we've realized at Bellingcat is that there's not many tools to help combat deepfake audio, for example, which is a huge threat. And that's something that Michael Colburn in the chat also highlighted, who's a researcher at Bellingcat as well. Obsidian Mirrors asks a related question, actually. I'd love to know how influential Sasha thinks weaponized AI is going to be during this election cycle, given the huge advancements in text-to-image/video models since 2020. What can be done about perception management campaigns leaning on the tech?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's obviously a
huge concern about this. My general sense is probably, and this I think aligns with what I hear from people who are on the front lines of this with campaigns, they are more worried about audio, deepfake audio, presumably AI generated, than they are about visual, whether still image or video. I think that probably few reasons for this, some of which I'm sure all of you have thought about, which are there are more cues, I think, to the untrained eye, even on visual content than there are in audio content. It's harder to obviously dwell on one corner of the way you would dwell on one part of an image to look for inconsistencies in any bit of something visual. It's much harder, obviously, to do that with a bit of audio. Also, you know, just the delivery device. So let's just go back to that New Hampshire example. It shows up on people's phones. So they pick up their phone and they hear 30 seconds of Joe Biden, quote unquote, Joe Biden, talking to them. It then goes away. And unless they record it, there's no way to go back and listen to it again to try to be like, wait, is that really Joe Biden? Whereas obviously, if you get a picture, you presumably can look it over once or twice if it raises doubts. So I think I think audio is probably at this moment the biggest concern. All that said, I would caution against getting, at least in this space, you know, too concerned with the latest technological innovation. I mean, those three sort of major conspiracy theories I mentioned, none of them were based on any form of high-tech deception, right? So QAnon is the most low-tech thing you can have using computers, basically, right? I mean, it was like ASCII text on bulletin boards, but it told a compelling you know, it was a compelling world building exercise, and people wanted to believe it. You know, none of the vaccine skepticism, it wasn't like people were out there faking, using AI tools to fake Pfizer randomized control trials. It just, there were existing doubts about the credibility of big pharma, about governments, about scientific expertise, and people raised a kind of coherent set of doubts that resonated with a significant part of our population and in other countries too. And you know, the stuff about the 2020 election that ends up leading to January 6th and beyond is mostly one guy talking into a microphone on a camera. So I think we should definitely be, I think it's, it is certain, we've already seen this campaign year affected, shaped in certain ways by AI generated disinformation. But I think people who think of the problem as an artificial intelligence problem and the solution as a, you know, regulation or accountability or watermarking for artificial intelligence, whatever it may be, are, and then we'll think like, okay, well, you know, we've sort of dealt with the disinformation problem. And the bigger issue is we have a, you know, a public that is primed to receive and accept certain types of lies and, you know, a disintegration of traditional institutions of expertise that mediated a shared understanding of baseline truth on issues of public concern. And that you could, you know, come up with all the watermarks on photos. You're not going to really be addressing that issue.
Yeah, exactly. AI isn't the problem, but it's a tool that's being used.
The other AI example, which I'll say is like not in the area of generative contents, but you know, just the ability to create contents at scale very quickly at zero cost. And you know, the people sort of lay out the nightmare scenarios on this, but it's not that there's one piece of content that you know, has Joe Biden saying something that he didn't say about Israel and Gaza. It's 1,000 accounts that all pop up with different audio of Joe Biden saying slightly different things about what he says about Israel and Gaza, and just a sort of fog of war that comes from the inability of anybody to persuasively identify which one is the real and which ones are the fake. And I suspect that type of mass confusion can be facilitated with AI, far more easily than it would be with manual tools.
Yeah, flooding the social media sphere with information is definitely a way, a tactic. Michael Coleman, actually, this really relates to what he's asked. We've had a lot of questions coming through, and I'm excited to ask you this one. But this one's kind of related to what we're talking about. A question about something a scholar told me about that I hadn't looked into. Apparently, in Argentina, Javier Milei's campaign and supporters used an absolute ton of AI-created memes to flood the digital space. Not fakes or anything, but just a bombardment of easy memes. Is this something you've come across, the use of AI to just overwhelm the public space with content? I mean, you've just hinted at
it. Yeah, I've been trying to follow the Argentina example from here, too. I mean, you know,
I think that there are two trends that are intersecting here. One is is the tech story, which I guess is sort of what we've been talking about and the way AI facilitates this. The other thing is something, especially in the U.S., is the ways in which campaigns, and this is a sort of transformational role that Donald Trump played, have empowered and encouraged their supporters to generate content. You know, the traditional political campaign, especially in the United States, but in, you know, and there's some countries where this is, you know, more or less true. So, but let me just talk about the U.S. for a second here. Is a command and control enterprise, right? So campaigns spend a lot of money up front to do research. They do policy research, they do issue research, they do opposition research, they do opinion research, and they come up with clear set of, you know, what exactly they want to talk about down to the word and to which, you know, parts of the country, parts of the electorate, they want to target that messaging and when. And that's been the case for you know, in some form or another for certainly 100 years in the United States. And what happened when the internet came along, you know, we'll say roughly 2000, when campaigns began starting to explore the internet as a tool for political communication, campaigns maintained that mentality of we want to communicate with a singular unified voice. And when they saw the internet as a place to migrate types of communication and tactics that had worked offline online when they could be made cheaper and easier there, right? So what happened with sort of, you know, back when we called it cyberspace, what happened with political cyberspace in the early 2000s was that campaigns started building up lists to ask people for money, used it to make volunteer tasks easier so that, you know, you no longer had to go into a party office to make phone calls, but now you could do it from home. Campaigns maybe ask people to share content, but it was campaigns never entrusted their supporters to build and develop relationships online to communicate on the campaign's behalf, because in the old world, you would not have told your most enthusiastic volunteers, "Hey, go talk to people about abortion." Like, that would be the worst thing you could do on a campaign. It's like, no, we've decided what exactly we say on abortion and when and how and where we say it. And that was basically the mentality that campaigns brought to the internet. And so when you think about the success stories of the first and second generation of online campaigning in the US, and Barack Obama is sort of the avatar of this, they were great at basically building contact lists. And they built a lot of very weak ties online. Largely that they asked for money and volunteer help. And Donald Trump had a very different orientation, purely out of instinct, I think, not out of any, you know, overarching theory of online communication. But Donald Trump, because, you know, he would post whatever back on Twitter back in the day, like would post whatever he thought was interesting at any moment of the day, but also would amplify and share things that his supporters posted that he thought was interesting, like, you know, and sometimes it was posts that weren't really true, and sometimes it was memes or GIFs or, like, you know, homemade DIY content. And it was content that was often at odds with what the you know, preferred messaging of his campaign would be at any point. But what he did was he empowered his supporters to communicate on his behalf in a way that traditional political campaigns had never done in the United States. And I think that the communities that have formed there are deeper and more meaningful than anything that Obama or his supporters built, in part because people feel empowered to campaign on to communicate on Trump's behalf. And so there's a sort of belated realization in the United States among Democratic campaigners that there are a lot of culprits to the sort of prevalence of disinformation online, right? So there are bad actors who are creating it for all sorts of reasons. There are platforms that are in many ways walking away from previous commitments they had made to moderate content, all of this. But I think that many Democrats are starting to realize that they lost the internet and that they use political campaigns to create a lot of weak ties online, and they are now seeing what happens when people with stronger ties use it to push out bad information. And so the Malay example, which is, I think, you know, using AI, but the fundamental difference is the sort of decentralization of political speech. It is a political elite telling his supporters, sending a message to supporters that you guys, what you have to say for the campaign is valuable, and encouraging them to do that. And that is that gets back to that asymmetric dynamic I talked about earlier, because under the old model, if Javier Milei posts something or says something or in an interview or you know, a member of his future cabinet or whatever says something that is wrong or inaccurate or just, you know, reflects an unpopular opinion, then his political opponents can go to the newspaper and say, "This guy's a liar," or "Look at what his policies would do." And there'd be a form of political accountability that could be delivered to him if voters are bothered by that. When you have individuals, they're not accountable the same way. And so I think that you know, we should be thinking about the ways that the power is shifting from political speakers who can be held accountable through the political process to individuals who may be anonymous. They may be, you know, people using AI, but I think the point is that they're not sort of accountable political actors.
Really interesting point. I think it also actually, funnily enough, mimics the way that social media growth and trends have changed as well, from kind of this passive consumer to more of an active voice as well. And encouraging that part in terms of the voters and elections is an interesting and obviously powerful tactic that Trump
has. Look, this is a shift that brands and other institutions are dealing with too, right? I mean, the upside is that you use your followers and supporters online to communicate on your behalf. The downside is that they will invariably say things that are at odds with that you'll have to answer for, or that are odds with your preferred messaging. And I think political communicators in the United States have been slower than others to recognize the upside of those trade-offs, and have been refocused until very recently on the downside of relinquishing that control. But are now, especially on the American left, beginning to recognize that it is, if you are going to be able to communicate effectively online, both to push back in a reactive way against disinformation narratives, but also to get your message out proactively, you need to entrust your supporters to do that. And so we have an example, you know, John Fetterman ran for Senate in Pennsylvania in 2022, set up a Slack channel where I think at some point 8,000 of his supporters were, you know, sharing gifts and memes and ideas for jokes online. And it was, you would never have imagined a campaign in a previous era saying to its most enthusiastic supporters, like, you know, we're going to encourage you to come up with funny stuff to say. Yeah.
Sarah's just written in the chat, I think the last 5 minutes have given me more insight into why Trump was so beloved by online people than 8 years of think pieces. A few people.
I'll read some of those same pieces, so I don't know.
Due to what happened on January 6th, is there a way to figure out something like this is going to happen imminently? As in, is something going to happen in this area, existing a large crowd under one unified overall political ideology? And then Don has asked, Pedro has asked, do you think this type of warfare will eventually become so strong that it can replace the original warfare? So I guess both of them are kind of asking, in terms of this empowerment of groups, in terms of this empowerment of voters, in terms of this empowerment of individual voices, do you think we're able to predict where those movements can move to online? Is any part of your research kind of looked into any part of predicting future movements of these kinds of groups, or is that too out of the ballpark of your
So I think that, like, a few of the bigger trends here that we've seen, right, are
online disinformation leading to offline action, and so January 6th is probably, in the U.S. instance, the most significant, both in the scale and impact example of that. But you go back to 2016, and there was what people call Pizzagate, somebody who sort of QAnon follower or proto QAnon follower who showed up at a pizzeria in DC with guns, thinking that Democrats were running a pedophile ring out of there. Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's husband, was attacked in their home by somebody who was a believer in QAnon and sort of related conspiracies. And so, yes, we have examples of violence and real world harm being delivered to folks. And I do think this is one of the challenges, and I write about this in the book, sort of through the eyes of some Democratic members of Congress. One of the challenges they have is separating their concern, their personal concern, their kind of concern, national security concern, from their electoral interests. I tell the story of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. So this is the House Democrats campaign arm in 2019, launches a counter disinformation task force. And so they're the first real, like, party organization in the United States to make this a dedicated role. And the chairwoman of the committee, who's a sitting congresswoman, and sets up a dinner for some Democratic members of Congress to introduce them to the head of this task force, who's a young digital operative. And because they're politicians, before he can talk, they all have to be able to go around and talk first. And so they're asked to just go around and say, hey, why are you here? Why do you care about disinformation? And members, you know, one member from South Florida is talking about how she had been attacked with word of mouth on local talk radio and had to hire private security for her family because she was getting threats as a result of it. Then members who were on the Intelligence Committee who were talking about their concern about disinformation as a geopolitical tool. And it was just illustrative of how they all wanted to do something. And often the correct answer tactically when it comes to disinformation is do nothing because it can be counterproductive. And I think one of the challenges for politicians in the United States, and I would expect in other countries too, is that the desire, when you see the real world harms, the desire to do something, often you can't have it's difficult to bring a proper sense of proportion to the do something. So then the word sort of becomes to your staff, we need to push back, we need to do something on everything. And you shouldn't do something on everything because some disinformation is actually not getting out of a closed circle online. And so to get to the question about predicting, you know, there are, I don't know of any particular tools that are predicting kind of real world outcomes. And I would be suspect as a non-statistician that we have enough of a training set to model what leads to a January 6th, because we've had only one. But one of the big challenges, one of the, you know, the most useful, some of the most useful tools for the people I write about are efforts to model how information moves on online landscapes. Because from the perspective of let's say you're Joe Biden's, you're the Democratic National Committee, right? And you have, as they do, people who are dedicated to this sort of counter disinformation work. What you'll see on any given day is that there may be stuff that's, you know, in trending topics on a website, is getting, you know, a lot of views, whatever that means, that is attacks Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or Nancy Pelosi or whomever. But it's being created by Trump supporters for other Trump supporters, because that is, in many ways, as I think Sarah said, like, that's part of the way that this community is shaped and bonded, is that they create this stuff to amuse themselves and impress one another. And so it may hurt your feelings as a politician if they're saying mean or bad things about you, but it's not necessarily getting in front of the 10% of the American electorate whose votes are in play. And so some of the most useful social media monitoring tools are trying to model what are the patterns of movement that can help us predict what jumps out of those contained corners of the internet and get into in front, you know, into the sort of mainstream in a way. And so that campaigns can make decisions, intelligent decisions about which ones to take seriously based on which accounts retweet them. Are there sort of patterns of movement that allow you to early on anticipate that? Because that's basically the game for campaigns, is only a small share of what's the lies about you on the internet any given day. And this is true of like any public figure, public institution. People are going to lie about you and the issues you care about every day on the internet. Only a small share of those, portion of those, are going to affect your vote share, your, you know, sales, your stock price, your popularity. And the challenge is how to separate the signal from the noise. And so these sort of statistical modeling tools are designed to, yeah, what are the patterns of movement that lead to the things that will actually be harmful, and can give you confidence to ignore the rest.
Yeah, amplification happens when you start replying or start amplifying it, and then it explodes often, especially if you have a large following on social media and you start engaging with some of the theories or some of the claims, it becomes a lot bigger than it might have originally been when you first encountered it. This actually relates to a question Sarah asked earlier, which was, Sasha, have you seen any campaigns, US or otherwise, which handled mal-dis misinformation effectively? And if so, how did they do it? So you just touched on some of the tools that campaigners use, but is there any particular campaign who's really managed a disinformation claim really well that you could speak to?
Yeah, so I have a chapter about what the Biden campaign did in 2020, and they ended up in the summer of 2020 after he wins the Democratic nomination. They end up in an unusual and enviable position for a political campaign, which is they have a fair bit of time and quite a bit of money to play with. And so they decide that they are going to their digital department, led by a guy named Rob Flaherty, who was the digital director of the campaign. He then had that job in the White House and is now deputy campaign manager. I'll point out for this audience, he is among the people who sort of, I think his thinking, I'll go back to what they did in 2020, but some of his shaping, some of his thinking then, some of his thinking from this experience is what I think shaped the way that the White House and National Security Council communicated about run-up and early days of the Ukraine invasion, being more proactive in trying to counter what they thought of as disinformation at that time. So go back to 2020. Flaherty's idea was we need to identify what he called the market-moving disinformation. Right. So this is sort of what we were just talking about. The idea that, as he said, I care only about the disinformation that is going to move votes. If it's not going to cost us a vote, it's not my problem. It may be a problem for society. It may be a problem for the platforms. But all I care about is stuff that's going to get in front of that small share of persuadable voters or maybe demoralize Biden's own base. And so to identify the market moving disinformation, they did a large research study in which they surveyed persuadable voters. And so they created a list of basically viral narratives. Some of these were more grounded in truth than others. So disinformation is kind of a catch-all that's not always the most useful description. But these were all viral narratives that were circulating online, that had actually been tracked by the team that Jory Craig, who I mentioned earlier, had assembled doing this work. And they included, you know, some things. They often use Trump's shorthand because he's quite good at this. So Sleepy Joe was how they referred to stuff about Biden's age and his mental acuity. Creepy Joe, we don't hear a lot about this anymore, but there was a period where we did that Biden was sort of handsy with young women. Stuff about Kamala Harris both being either too far left or too much of a cop. And then they actually seeded the survey with what they called red herrings. They made up some fake storylines just to set a baseline for what people will say that they had heard. So one of these was the idea that Biden belonged to a discriminatory all-white country club, which is actually in no way true, but still people told the pollsters that they were familiar with this. And the core of this was two questions that they asked these persuadable voters. One, are you familiar with this storyline? And two, does it affect does it make you less likely to vote for Joe Biden against Donald Trump? And they mapped these on a grid. One axis was the reach of the storyline, how many persuadable voters were familiar with it. And the other axis was the impact, how many of them said that they would it would affect their opinion. And basically, the first decision the campaign made was that we only care about stuff in the upper right-hand corner. If it's anything below that, like, it's not our problem. But what they found was, for example, that the stuff related to Hunter Biden and the corruption allegations it had a lot of reach. A lot of persuadable voters said that they were familiar with this. I mean, so we're at a point in 2020 where Trump has already been impeached for the first time for withholding aid to Ukraine to try to gin up an investigation on Hunter Biden. So a lot of people are familiar with this, but they say it actually won't affect their opinion and their vote. And focus groups reveal it's because they don't actually see Biden as motivated by personal financial gain. So it just doesn't affect their it doesn't sort of ring true to them. But the stuff, the Sleepy Joe stuff about his age, it has big reach. It also has big impact. Voters are saying that it will make them less likely to vote for Biden. And the focus groups reveal they're not actually worried about his physical fitness. So the way that the communication staff of the campaign had been dealing with the age stuff was they set up photo ops for him to ride around on a bicycle and like had him run up the stairs to his plane. And the focus groups revealed that the issue wasn't that voters were concerned that Biden wouldn't get his steps in if he was president. It was that they saw him as a fundamentally weak political figure. I think this has a lot to do with having been vice president, having sort of won the Democratic nomination, but never driving the conversation, never being the main character of that primary campaign. And voters, these persuadable voters, at least, they said that they didn't really know what Biden believed or care about, that they worried that he, to quote one of his pollsters, wouldn't be the author of his presidency. So this manifests itself in receptivity to claims about his age, but it wasn't fundamentally about his age. It was that they worried that they didn't know what he would do if he were in office, who would really call the shots. And so the campaign's response to this wasn't stuff that showed him physically active. They started doing things like buying digital ads that got that if you went and searched Biden and senile, for example, on Google, they would try to cookie you so that they could serve you a 15-second digital ad later that showed Biden speaking to camera, unedited, about what he wanted to do with economic policy. If you saw this, you would have no reason to assume this was about his age. But from the campaign's perspective, they were making a shift from what they described as confronting misinformation as a supply side problem, which was the sort of traditional mentality, and I think remains the way that many people think of this now across spheres, not just in politics, which is, okay, there's something that's moving today online. It could be a misleading post. It could be a deep fake audio or video. It could be a conspiracy theory. And we need to track and address that. And they thought that instead of a supply side approach, they were having a demand side approach. The narratives that would be most harmful to Biden's candidacy were those that responded to existing anxieties or concerns that voters had about him, about the country, about issues. And the way to respond to those was not to push back on the individual disinformation claim. It was to get to try to resolve the underlying anxiety. And so this is the mentality that they bring to this now. And I think it is the sort of like smartest overarching approach I've seen from a campaign in the United States to thinking about this. It also is one that is probably off limits to all but the best funded campaigns in this country. And so unless you're a presidential campaign or maybe a big statewide candidate running for governor or senator, the amount of time and investment that they had to have some of these disinformation narratives familiar enough up front to actually put them in front of voters, it's not easily reproducible for people running for, mayor, for running for Congress on their own.
Such interesting insight. That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that with us. Ian, as you were talking, wrote, there's some extremely good graph analysis looking at the amplification of tweets during the Brexit campaign. They show how few people were involved in original tweets and how they were amplified through sock puppet accounts and gullible people. The additional analysis then looked at those accounts and tried to identify where they were coming from. A surprising number were not new accounts, and it was put down to organizations who invested heavily in building false personas just to add authenticity to misinformation campaigns. In some cases, they were far better at creating backstories than government agencies. Brexit, of course, is another case where misinformation and the lack of kind of acknowledgement of individual voices was something that kind of contributed to the Brexit vote. Don Don has asked, and something that we haven't covered yet, is social platforms in terms of specific social platforms. I think in the 2016 election, Facebook played a large role, and you spoke a little bit about Facebook's role earlier. But Don Don asks, I'm interested to know Sasha's opinion on one, the impact, and two, the timing of the US working to pass laws to ban platforms like TikTok. And I wanted, as a secondary question, just to ask, is there any particular social media platforms that you think researchers should keep their eye on in the election, in this next election period, for disinformation campaigns?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. So I'm not sure in the American sort of policymaking context, there's anything like TikTok. I think TikTok is being treated very much as its own case, and the legislation that passed the House last week or the week before, whatever, is designed to affect TikTok and ByteDance and no one else, and is sort of in the absence of a more all-encompassing approach to social media regulation. There's been, you know, I think probably too much disproportionate attention paid on Facebook because of the central role it played in 2016, the impact of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. I mean, it is the sort of central player in the American social media landscape. And then disproportionate attention paid to Twitter because up until fairly recently, they had good data and visibility on. So it was kind of researcher friendly, both for people inside campaigns and then outsiders, including you guys. So you could actually get some sense of, like, probably persuade yourself of some omniscience working with Twitter, that you were kind of seeing everything that was going on the platform. TikTok and you can map networks because you could see followers and all that stuff. Like, TikTok is pretty far on the other end. It's completely, or it's largely opaque. Content doesn't have permanent links, so it's very hard actually to track a piece of content. Either see it or you don't often. The big challenge in the US this year, and this is gonna to folks in other parts of the world, not feel as novel as I think it is to people in the US, but is messaging apps. And so the US has been a very late adopter of group messaging apps. My best understanding is that has mostly to do with the fact that cell phone companies stopped charging for individual text messages earlier than they did in other countries. And so there was never any great economic advantage to using WhatsApp or Signal or Telegram or whatever it may be, unless you were in a space where you cared about the encryption. But we do see, you know, especially in immigrant communities in the United States, an increasing reliance on those messaging apps, you know, which have become like a hybrid in communities, a hybrid of kind of group text apps and effectively broadcast platforms. So you have examples of tens, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people, particularly in non-English speaking areas where there's not as much of a traditional media infrastructure, and people coming from countries in the Spanish-speaking world, from South East Asia, where use of those apps are sort of more routinized than they are among, you know, native-born Americans, I would say. And these are really tricky for researchers of any kind, because they're entirely closed. They're not even really platforms, but the apps, the companies can quite honestly wash their hands of content moderation responsibilities, because they don't actually have visibility into encrypted content. The way that campaigns are dealing with this in the United States, so I mentioned the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. So this is an organization that helps Democrats who are running for the House of Representatives around the country staff their campaigns, basically. And in the old days, when they would send a field organizer out to a district, give this person a bunch of data on the people who volunteered last time, and they'd say, go find an empty storefront on Main Street and, you know, buy some cheap tables and chairs and order some pizza and call the volunteers and bring them in and get them enthusiastic about our new candidate and tell them to go recruit their friends and we'll teach them how to go knock on doors. That was like the first job you had as a field organizer. Now they send people out into the country, and especially in Southern California, where there are competitive districts with large Vietnamese communities, for example, in South Florida, where there are large Spanish-speaking communities from Venezuela, Central America, Cuba. The first thing is go meet people who are active in the community and get invited to all of the closed groups that are out there. And they have set up a kind of funnel for folks in the field to who are getting into these groups, these community groups, which are often not explicitly political in their orientation, but they're just where people in those communities get their news. And they've set up a kind of reporting structure so that that field organizer can report, hey, you know, here's what people in the, you know, Vietnamese language community groups are talking about today. And let the people in Washington, you know, it used to be that you could go look at the front page of the newspaper or turn on the radio and know what information voters were getting. And now you need to do, and it's ultimately like, we talked about the sort of advanced statistical modeling work to understand how stuff is moving across social platforms. This is, you talk to the people who are doing this and it feels a lot closer to like old school intelligence gathering or ethnographic research where, yeah, like, you know, write up a cable and send it back to the ministry about what the folks in the cafes in Damascus are saying today. And somebody there will see if it lines up with what they're picking up from, you know, the economic attaché. And, but it's really necessary in a world of closed messaging apps.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Sasha. That was super interesting. Closed messaging apps is definitely something that needs more focus on, not only in the US, but globally. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. I know there's a bunch of you had really interesting questions that we haven't been able to cover. Sasha, how do people get in contact with you, or how do people reach out to you if anybody has further questions?
That's my website. This is my email. And whatever Twitter is called now, that's my Twitter handle, although I mostly use it to make obscure jokes. But I'm reachable in all the places.
Fantastic.
And, like, and you can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook and all the other stuff there.
Yeah, for those listening to the podcast, that's www.sashaeisenberg.com, sashaeisenberg@gmail.com, and the Twitter or X is at Sissenberg, Sissenberg. Thank you so much, Sasha, for your time today. We could pick your brains forever. But I think
I really enjoyed it. It's actually in you all.
Yes. If you haven't been convinced yet to go out and buy Sasha's book, were you even listening? You can find The Lie Detectives online in major back bookstores now and on Sasha's website. Thank you so much, Sasha. And the next stage talk will be in 2 weeks' time. Thank you, everybody, for joining.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.